still have a few more minutes.
I'm also mindful I'm 7 months away from inheriting an organization where a lot of this stuff is up in the air. So I'm really clear and on the record about that.
I think
I'm proud of you. I think it's great to be compared with your one.
Yeah.
That's great.
So it's meant as a compliment.
I just want to make sure we all got that too. Neither of us want to hear about it later.
Or the public record. Do I have a motion?
I move a staff recommendation.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.
Okay, Carl.
We have three OSGD-related matters in front of the board today. Two require OIC approval are addressed through the staff memo. They are specifically one to extend the consulting contract with Safety Advisory Group for another 1 year term, and two to relax the limitations on a self-directed brokerage account option. I think the staff memo addressed the basic rationale for these recommendations, and so at this point, I'll answer any questions that the board may have.
So the self-directed brokerage, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of money in there.
That's correct.
There's a lot of participants in there.
Yeah.
What's the general profile or demographic of those who are
We actually don't have great information on the demographics of those participants who invest in there. So if I recall correctly, there are 117, 120 folks who have a self-directed brokerage account. The average assets they have is about $50,000. And given that they're only limited to 50% of their assets, that means on average, the most they could have is about 100,000. Right? The least amount of assets they have is about 100,000 on average, which is greater than the average in the entire demographics of OSGP. So all I can say is, in general, they seem to have a little bit more money on average than the rest of the population. We don't really know much more about them than that. And you know, I think just to paraphrase what our investment consultant said to me one time, we really have three different tracks within OSGP. We have a track of those options where a participant can outsource the entire asset allocation and design, which are the target date funds. We have a middle, which is those who want to handle the asset allocation but don't want to pick the managers, and those are essentially the vast majority of the remaining options. And then the third are just those who, for whatever reason, want to just do it completely themselves, pick stocks, pick funds. Maybe these participants have money outside of the OSGP. You know, OSGP is a completely voluntary plan. So, you know, these are also folks, for the most part, are vested with the PERS. And so they have that piece as well. So I can't exactly say what the demographics are of those participants who select this, but, you know, it is a completely voluntary plan, and for whatever reason, they choose to go down this route.
What's the impetus for wanting to make this change?
Well, this actually came from the advisory committee. So the advisory committee back in February approved a motion to recommend relaxing the constraints from a maximum of 50%, raising it to 75% of the assets. They had also debated whether or not they should lower the minimum balance from $10,000 down to either $5,000 or $7,500. This, I think, in thinking about it, this seems like a minor set of guidelines around one specific option for a very limited number of folks. And so my thinking is, instead of going back to the board yet again when, you know, the advisory committee wants to make another change to constraints, just open up a little bit more with the expectation that the advisory committee will set a more strict guideline than what the board would approve, and that would just be the governing guidelines based on feedback and input that the advisory committee gets from the participants.
Question. In looking at the list of all the people that are involved in the administration, it seems like there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen. and it wasn't clear to me what the consultant does, and I never could find out how they're paid and how much they're paid.
They're paid, well, they're paid out of the 7 basis points of administration fee. So all participants are charged 10 basis points of trustee fees and 7 basis points for administrative fees. And the consultant, the contract is negotiated between Treasury and the consultant, but ultimately it's being paid for by the participants of the plan.
I saw that, but St. Fee doesn't get the full 7 basis points, does it?
No, they do not, yeah.
It's, what do they get?
It's less than $100,000 a year.
So
what role do they play?
So they help staff, both Treasury and LSGP, on matters related to the plan. So they help select managers. They help, you know, review the design and the options. They, earlier in the term of the contract, they helped to select Voya Financial to be the record keeper. So they are a generalist advisor, if you will.
So you're only looking for a one-year extension because you're trying to figure out if this is going to work based upon the split?
Well, right now, so this year will conclude the second of the two-year extension with SageView, with the predecessor firm of Armitage Messina. We had originally intended to do an RFP for an investment consultant this year, but OSGP and PERS are currently reviewing the structure of this defined contribution plan, the deferred comp plan. And so instead of doing an RFP for an investment consultant this year, it felt like it made sense to table that for one more year while PERS and OSGP review the OSGP to see how any future consultant, what role any future consultant may play.
So it's not that you're concerned about SageView's ability to perform this, and you're just giving them a little bit of time to settle out. You're fine with that.
That's correct, yeah. I mean, okay. We still have the same consultant we've had for 7 years. Okay. We're happy with the service we provided. It's just there are other issues on a strategic level.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
The delay Carl's talking about is more at our request than theirs. They were ready to go forward with this RFP. And as he's alluding to, and maybe you'll hear a little more about, we talk about the program. We're kind of trying to figure out what OSGP wants to be when it grows up. So we're doing our own RFP that we're going to issue at the end of this year for a third-party administrator,
okay. The
Voya role today. And rather than have this precede that, we thought it would be better to follow it. So we're asking the investment consultant role that Carl was agreeable enough to put that off and let us do the overall planning before we got to the investment consulting.
Makes sense. Thank you. Okay, any other questions? Any other comments, Carl?
No other comments.
Okay. Do I have a motion?
So moved. Second.
All in favor?
Are we moving on both of his requests?
We're moving on both. Okay. I assume. Yes. Okay. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay.
Thanks.
Great. Third part.
Yep. Then the third and final, all should really matter, is an overview of the plan. And with us today are Roger Smith and Kathy Gannon, who will provide that overview.
Great. Thank you.
We really appreciate the opportunity to come forward today and tell you a little bit about the plan and to answer any questions you may have. And as you know, we have Carl here from Treasury and Jake from SageView to help us. I'm really pleased to have my program coordinator here, Kathy. She's been with the program for many, many years. I've been back before it was under the purview of PERS. So we'll just go through the presentation here, and please ask any questions that you may deem appropriate. Obviously, we're a 457 deferred compensation plan that provides Oregon public employees with a convenient way to save for retirement by allowing them to contribute a portion of their salary on a pre- or after-tax basis. And we are the 457 plan for the state of Oregon employees and also for local governments that elect to participate in the program. And on the second page, it deals a little bit more in deep detail. As Carl mentioned, and as Director Rodman mentioned, you know, there's several sides to employees' retirement, and we obviously have the PERS pension side, and we offer the 457 deferred compensation as a voluntary program to ensure they have an adequate retirement. PERS recently adopted their 2015-2020 strategic plan in regards to member service communications. And really what we're trying to do as an agency is reach out to all participants and members and encourage them to save for retirement. And when Director Rodman asked me to go down to OSGP and assume the role as the manager, I brought with me 12 years of experience here as a customer service manager. So one of the things that I'm trying to do is integrate OSGP into the overall retirement plan for our participants and members. And keep in mind that not all OSGP participants are PERS members. We do have local governments that do not elect to participate in PERS. So just a little history. 1978, Section 457 of the Internal Revenue Code was enacted. And in 1981, our first deferrals went into the Oregon Savings Growth Plan. As I mentioned earlier with Kathy Gannon here, in 1991, OSGP was moved from the executive department over to PERS for management administration.
If I may, yes. I'm just reflecting on what you just said. So an employee could be a public employee, could be not a member of PERS, but a member of this.
Yes.
Interesting. How does it work on the payroll?
As far as payroll reporting, I'll turn that over to Kathy. That's what she spends most of her day is coordinating the payroll mechanism between that and our third-party administrator.
Yeah. So with the local governments, you know, so outside of the state realm, the local governments who adopt our plan to be provided to their employees, they set up a direct payroll work with our third-party record keeper, so that can be transmitted through their payroll anyway by ACH. There's a program called Payroll Admin within our third-party record keeper. They actually can send fiscal paychecks. A lot of the local governments that participate in our plan are smaller, so you know their number of employees can be anywhere from 2 to 3 to 20, and so a lot of them will hire an outside payroll processing source to process their payroll, and so it would be an outside third party that would then work with our record keeper to get those dollars into the Oregon Savings Growth Plan, then eventually into our personal participants' accounts.
But you said in the introductory part that your part of your role is to encourage people to save, and you're able to do that even outside the PERS program.
Yes.
Yes.
The educational.
Yes. As you'll see further on in the presentation, we have outreach on the PERS side, and we also have outreach that we do specifically to OSGP. And there's as you can imagine, there's quite a bit of overlap, and we're looking at efficiencies and the opportunities maybe with a new third-party administrative contract that can, again, bring all those resources to bear.
People tend to think of PERS as a monolith. But honestly, you talk in terms of member education and in terms of a three-legged stool. To be prepared for retirement, you need private savings, you need your public retirement and Social Security. There is not overlap over those three legs in any one entity. There are public employers that do not participate in Social Security, that do not participate in PERS, that do not participate in OSGP. So it is something of a challenge to coordinate, as Mr. Smith is talking about, getting all of those elements to align through education when you don't have complete coverage. So that's one of the things we're talking about, is how do we better improve that coverage between OSGP and PERS, as those are two entities we obviously control, and we administer the Social Security on behalf of the state of Oregon as well.
In 1996, the plan investment lineup was restructured. 1997, a trust was created and the PERS board named the trustee. And in 1999, the first local government adopted OSGP. And with the local governments, we can be a pro provider, but there are many local governments that have us as one of their providers, depending on what their agreement is. The oversight and authority administration, as I mentioned, the first board is a trustee, and of course we have the treasury and OIC as an investment oversight. Currently, our record keeper is Voya, and we're going through the process right now of extending that contract for 1 year as we go through, as what Carl mentioned. We have a consultant on board that's helping us understand what our business needs and our strategy is in preparation for a third-party administrator renewal contract.
Just for the record, if I may, Voya is a tenant of mine.
Pardon me?
Voya is a tenant of mine, just for the record.
Thanks, sir. The administration, obviously, is through PERS and the OSGP staff. As Carl mentioned, the consultant is currently SageView, and we also have a seven-member panel that helps us with the advisory committee. The actual day-to-day staffing of the OSGP offices, as mentioned, I'm the manager. Kathy's our program coordinator. We have a program analyst. And we have three retirement counselors on staff that assist not only with OSGP-related questions, but they are also can assist with any PERS questions that our walk-in or callers may have. As you may know, our OSGP office is located in the State Archives Building, and we have a service center there that services both OSGP and PERS members and participants. In regards to the program outreach on the OSGP side, we have two full-time presenters that go out and do presentation workshops and assist one-on-one enrollments. Voya also, by contract, supplies two additional counselors that do the exact same thing. They're out there representing OSGP and providing those resources. Some of the highlights, we added a loan program in 2007, and in 2008 we added the target date funds, and we'll show you a little bit more detailed breakout of the investment opportunities. As Carl mentioned, the self-directed brokerage window was added in 2009, and as recently as 2012 we added the Roth 457 after-tax program. And in 2015 we gave our participants the opportunity to invest in socially responsible funds. So what makes it attractive to many of our local governments and as well as the state is the low administrative fee, 7 basis points for OSGP administration, and the third party administrator is 10 basis points. The portability as our participants and members move throughout the state, local governments. It obviously goes with them. There's a 3-year catch-up provision that's quite popular, as I mentioned, the loans. We also have unforeseeable emergency withdrawal built into the plan, and that is something that is used quite a bit by our participants. There's a de minimis withdrawal clause in there, and obviously the exception on the 10% penalty on withdrawal before age 59 and a half. And some of the plan features, minimum contribution is $25 per month. We're exploring opportunities to go to a percentage, and we're working through some concepts with that. Currently, the maximum regular contribution is $18,000, and for people that are over age 50 is $24,000. The 3-year catch-up provision is $36,000 per year. Kathy can talk a little bit about the automatic rebalance feature.
Yeah, the automatic rebalance feature is just a feature for participants who can set up either on a quarterly or a semi-annual basis to have their accounts automatically balanced. So if somebody coming into the plan has indicated that they wanted a 50% split between maybe some stock investments and a fixed investments. Then, of course, you know, over a period of time, that balance, depending on returns, gets out of sync, and maybe you have now a 75-25. The automatic rebalance, what it'll do is it'll bring that balance to the 50-50, so it kind of creates that trade in there to do that, and so that's automatic. Being done again, or participants, of course, always have the capability of doing that themselves at any time.
And we also accept rollovers from other eligible plans. Many of the PERS members who retire opt to roll their IEP account balance into the Board of Savings Growth Plan. And they do consolidate many of their other qualifying IRAs into the plan. As I mentioned earlier, here's a list of all of our investment options, the target date funds, individual asset funds, and again, that self-directed brokerage option. A little bit of statistics. Currently about $1.7 billion in assets, 26,000 plus participants. And if you look at the plan growth history table there, you can see that the plan assets, participants, and the amount of local governments that are participating has continued to grow. We're proud of that over the last 5 years. And we're continuing our endeavors to grow.
Steve, when we get the number of PERS participants, does it include this number?
No.
It doesn't. So the 300,000, we add this to that amount to...
Yeah.
Okay.
You add it, but there's a lot of overlap.
Right. Okay. Same people, different accounts.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, some of our objectives going forward in the future, especially with, regarding a new third-party administrator contract, obviously we want to increase participation in deferrals. We want to really improve on our ability to provide outreach. On the PERS side, we have six retirement counselors that go throughout the state doing group presentations. We want to leverage that and work together more closely with them. A lot of times we have OSGP going out to Eastern Oregon, showing up at an agency, and days later we have PERS counselors going out there and showing up. So we're working together to improve efficiencies and, as a result, increase participation deferrals. We're working on a concept for state agencies where a new employee comes into the agency. They usually have an onboarding process that they go through with their HR department, and what we'd like to see is an opportunity for the employee at that time to make a decision to opt into the plan as opposed to waiting for a presentation or a workshop to happen. And then also, if they decide to opt out, we can collect that data and maybe do direct marketing months later to come back around when they're probably better suited to enroll in something like that. We're working currently with Voya on an online enrollment program. Currently, it's all paper forms, and we're hoping this will also increase enrollment where they can just go online and enroll. And again, as I mentioned, working on more engagement with the participant. We're working very closely with our advisory committee to develop new strategies to reach out to them. In our education, as I mentioned, presentations, workshops, one-on-one, and again, just trying to do a better job at using all the marketing tools that are available, statewide email and other mechanisms. The next few slides just show participation by payroll source. So if you look at the entire plan, about 17% of all eligible employees participate in the plan. And then it's broke down, obviously, by payroll source. And just a chart that shows the average contribution amount. And this is one that I find very valuable in trying to target people earlier in their career to start saving more, because as you can see, it becomes more important as they move through. We'd like to see this lower end move up. And the graph showing asset allocation. And the balances by age group. And that concludes our information.
Thank you very much.
Any additional questions? Again, thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Okay. Tom.
For the record, Tom Lofton, Morgan State Treasurer, Investment Division. I'm here today to provide the council with an update on the Intermediate Term Pool. I'm going to start off by just providing a little bit of background. We'll look at performance, and then we'll go through some of the new tools that the lab system is providing for portfolio management decisions. And then we'll follow up with a quick snapshot, or the most recent snapshot of the pool. On page two, just for a little background, the pool was created in 2010 for qualified state agencies to provide a vehicle for surplus funds with longer investment horizons and to provide for higher returns than would have been available or are available in the Oregon Short-Term Fund. Year over year, as of April 30th, the assets in the fund are up about 28% year over year, I think it's a little under 300 billion right now. There are 9 state agency funds participating in the pool. If we look to page 3 for the returns, certainly December 2015, in the past year, was the most difficult month for the fund, as you can see in the top graph. In that month, the Federal Reserve increased its rate paid on excess reserves by 25 basis points. The Treasury curve repriced higher, yields increased to both compensate for that increase as well as for the expectation future rate increases. In addition, credit spreads were still rising somewhat, increasing somewhat modestly, credit spreads being the additional yield charged for credit risk. So it was a little bit of a double whammy for the pool. And then beginning in January of that year, so a complete reversal on the part of Treasury yields. There was a risk-off sentiment in the market, mostly because of reduced global growth expectations and turmoil in the energy markets, and Treasury yield as a safe haven, Treasury prices improved and Treasury yields declined. Additionally, credit spreads began to increase at a more rapid pace. In fact, credit spreads increased up until about the third week of February, at which point commodities market found a little bit of footing, and really, since then, credit spreads have been on a gradual tightening trend since then. So, in effect, if you look at it from January, the rising credit spreads and the declining credit spreads, those two sides essentially canceled each other out. And the primary driver of returns year to date, as we'll see on the next page, has really been what's happened in the Treasury curve. If we look there at the bottom graph, The primary purpose, as I mentioned, for the pool is to generate higher returns than what would be available in the short-term fund. To date, the pool has largely accomplished that mission, generating about 3x on an annualized basis since its inception, 3x that of the short-term fund. With that said, Garrett Cudahy and Angela Schaefer are doing a great job, and they keep increasing their pay rate on their fund. I think they're 80-something basis points right now, so the job of the pool is not going to get any easier going forward. If we go to page 4, last year the council asked me what were the tools I was hoping to gain from the from Aladdin. And I answered at the time, I wanted tools to be able to analyze portfolio manager decisions and look at analyze the positioning of our internal investments, and importantly, be able to look at what happened and what we expected to have happened, and make sure that what we expected actually, or what we thought happened actually did happen. If we look at the top boxes here, here's two ways that Aladdin breaks down the returns for us as portfolio managers, market factors and accounting factors. It's just two different ways of breaking down the same returns. For market factors, the roll down as a bond matures towards ages towards maturity, it's priced against different points on the treasury curve. And a normal upward sloping treasury curve, the 3-year yield is lower than the 4-year yield, which is lower than the 5-year yield. And as the bond ages, the yield against which it's discounted gradually declines, and there's a natural upward movement to the price. And the larger the difference between those two points, the greater that expected price improvement is. The roll down return can be material. It's a relevant part of every investment decision, and it's right up there with the relative value analysis as well as the credit analysis for any investment. The OAS is the spread, and the change in spread. The 12 basis points there essentially tells me as a portfolio manager that on average, the perceived credit quality of the portfolio improved over the period and gained us 12 basis points in return. The overall spread level that's next to us is nothing more than the income earned for the credit risk that we took. Duration is the sensitivity of the performance of the portfolio relative to the average change in rates. Curve, on the other hand, looks at the sensitivity of the portfolio to the change in the shape of the structure. As we'll see on the next page, the portfolio's maturities are skewed towards shorter maturities. When treasury rates decline, longer dated the curve essentially flattens. So longer dated yields decline more than shorter dated yields. So with our portfolio being skewed towards shorter dated materials or shorter dated maturities, that was detrimental to the return. In fact, it subtracted 33 basis points from the return. Convexity is nothing more than the change in duration that took place during the period. It's also a proxy for the embedded optionality in the underlying investments. So the slightly positive return from convexity really underscores my assessment that the underlying investments in the portfolio are mostly option-free. There's very little optionality in the portfolio. And what optionality we had was not overly detrimental.
John, there'll be a quiz on these charts.
Yes, there will be. There will be. My point in this is really to show that these are insights that we just didn't have before, and it helps me to assess the decisions that I made as a manager and understand what sensitivities in the portfolio that maybe I didn't understand before, or that maybe I believed were there and were actually there.
This is because of Aladdin?
It is. It is.
Tom, my takeaway from the total line, and maybe you can help me think through this, but the takeaway from all the numbers is, on the upside, the roll down is the driver. On the downside, the curve is the driver. And you can't
Absolutely.
Control that. So you can control the roll down, but not the curve.
Right. Can't control the curve, but to that point, our maturities, as I mentioned, are skewed towards shorter
right.
maturities.
Right.
So we should have expected in the flattening curve that would have been a detriment to return. And in fact, it was.
It was. Why is the roll down the contributor then?
Why is it the roll down?
Yeah, I thought the roll down was the step down in the maturity comparison.
So you can go to a steeper, you can invest in a steeper, when you're looking at which bond to purchase, you can make that assessment, well, I want to be in a steeper portion of the curve.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe on a relative value scale, it looks a little better over here, but over here I can be in a steeper portion of the curve.
Mm-hmm.
And as that bond ages, it rolls down the curve.
Right.
And so that steepness decision helped to get that performance. Now, And yes, the curve flattened, but we certainly looked at individual positions relative to the steepness of the curve where we could.
So I guess my question more clearly is, how will this change your behavior? Because if you can't control the curve, you got some information about the roll down dynamics.
Yeah.
Will it affect your behavior other than knowing where the
quantifying what you're already doing?
What the attribute? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll affect my behavior. Number one is I break it down into individual sectors, and I look at where those sectors are positioned relative to roll down. Is it working? Did it not work?
Mm-hmm.
Do I need to reassess those positions? Mm-hmm. In those places, yes, absolutely. It lets me look back and say, okay, that worked, that didn't work. Why didn't it work? Did I purchase something that had too much optionality, and so it was not able to take advantage of the roll down like I thought it was?
Okay.
So real quickly on the right, those are mostly in accounting factors. Those are mostly self-explanatory. The one on the far right, trade, that looks at the trades that we executed relative to immediately observable market prices, and really looks at the efficiency of the trades. That half of the basis point is somewhat immaterial, but certainly if that number got large negative, it would make us look and say, you know, what's going on? Why are we trading so far away from the market? On the bottom of the page, the top contributors to return, as I mentioned, in a flattening yield curve, that means lower expectations of fewer future rate increases. You would expect in lower yields and a flattening curve that government-backed bonds as well as real estate investment trusts would do well. You find four of those there. As I mentioned earlier, in late February, early March, we felt like credit spreads had gone a little too far, a little bit oversold. Two purchases that we made at that time, the Citigroup purchase and the Morgan Stanley, the MSC 2015, which is a CMBS position, those have worked out well for the portfolio and continue to work well. On the flip side, issues in the energy sector detracted from the credit quality for both ConocoPhillips and TransAlta. And you'll see a lot of floaters in there, the FLTs, in an environment where future rate expectations aren't there, floaters aren't as valuable. Let's flip to the final page for the current snapshot. The greatest exposure in the portfolio is in corporates at about 38%. The second highest exposure is in securitized, which is in asset-backed securities and commercial mortgage-backed securities. And then finally, treasuries and government-backed agencies make up about 26% of the portfolio. If we look at duration contribution, fifth column over, which takes into account the market weighting, the most of the interest rate risk is housed in the corporate sector, and spread duration is a proxy for credit risk. That's also where most of the credit risk is housed. The book yield on the portfolio is currently around 2%. And if we look in the lower left, about 65% of the portfolio is in AA minus and above. The average rating on the portfolio is AA minus. And the weighted average maturity distribution on the right, the bulk of the maturities in the portfolio are in the 3 to 5 year bucket. It is skewed to the left, as you'll see. And I would expect this maturity distribution to remain pretty constant going forward for the portfolio. That said, are there any questions?
Do you cut the return on the ratings, too? I assume you can cut where you get your return.
What do you mean cut?
Well,
attribution.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. It would just be interesting to see.
Okay. I can provide that.
I assume it's in the... these.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay.
That's what I'm thinking too.
But as two of my better performers were Tennessee Valley Authority and 2020 securities, or 2020 treasuries. well. So,
mm-hmm.
So it's not, but the REITs in particular typically live in the triple B space, which would be critical.
So I've got a two-part question. I guess the first part is a question. Is there a policy in place that lets us know how much active risk you're allowed to take against your benchmark to the extent that you have a benchmark?
So we do have a benchmark. It's the Barclays Act 3 to 5 year. We have, in terms of risk, we have maximum exposure percentages to specific security types, asset backs, CMBS, mortgage backs in particular. We have a maximum duration, interest rate duration, that we can take of 3 years as well. So the risk limits are defined in those terms.
I think what would be helpful, I'm sure you guys are ready to look at this, but to be able to see what those risk limits are and whether you're within those bounds, but also how it compares to the benchmark.
Yep. Yep. That's good. So if you looked at us versus that benchmark right now, the biggest takeaway that you would see is that we're very underweight relative to the benchmark, extremely underweight agency mortgage-backed securities. And that's just in all honesty, that's a bandwidth issue. You'll see that we're overweight corporates. My background is in corporates. I feel more comfortable operating
in. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much,
Tom.
All right. We'll take a break until 10:45. So, are those emotions that you don't want to hear about?
Yes. Well, I also...